What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is LaShawn Harris. Harris is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University and former managing and book review editor for the Journal of African American History. She's a historian of U.S. history with a focus on African American, Black women's, and urban histories. Harris's scholarly essays have appeared in Journal of Social History, Journal of Urban History, and Souls, a critical journal of Black politics, culture, and society. Her first monograph, Sex Workers, Psychics, and Number Runners, Black Women in New York City's Underground Economy, was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2016. In 2017, Sex Workers, Psychics, and Number Runners won the Organization of American Historians' Darling Clark Hine Award Best Book in African American Women's and Gender History and the Philip Taft Labor Prize from the Labor and Working Class History Association. Harris's work has been featured in popular media outlets, including TV One, Glamour Magazine, Huffington Post, Elle, Vice, The History Channel, and Black Perspectives. In 2019, Harris was appointed to the Organization of American Historians' Distinguished Lectureship Program. Her book that we are discussing today is Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. Hi, LaShawn. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
LaShawn, a little bit about you and is relevant to the conversation we're having, how you came to need to tell the story. And I use the word need on purpose because these kinds of stories, this kind of work is not like, oh, I woke up one day and this is interesting. It's usually almost always a calling. Talk to us about that journey.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I'm from New York City. I'm from the Bronx. I was born in Harlem and raised in the Bronx. And when I finished my second book, I was looking for a topic. I thought that I would just continue to stay in New York. I love doing research in New York. It gives me a chance to see family. And the archive spaces are really great in New York City. But I also knew that I wanted to do something on Black women and some of the things that I didn't explore in my first book, policing of Black women, activism, and then just really thinking about the Bronx. Those are the things I thought about for the first book. And after, you know, kind of talking with my mom about my first project and then about this project, I thought, you know, why not do something on the community in which I was raised, which is the University Avenue community. And I remember the Bumpers case. I was 10 years old when Eleanor Bumpers was killed by police on October 29th, 1974. And I lived across the street from her. And my parents actually knew her daughter, Mary Bumpers. She was our neighbor. So I really wanted to understand, you know, the person behind this kind of famous, iconic photo that appears that many activists use today. And I really wanted to understand the upheaval and the protests that came as a result of her killing. But if you're into popular culture, the image of Bumpers has always been with me. You know, she is shouted out in several of Spike Lee's films, including She's Gotta Have It, the other film that came out in 1989, Do the Right Thing. And she's all over in rap lyrics of the late, you know, 1980s and 1990s. So I feel like she's always been with me in terms of this is someone who was in my neighborhood. So I came to the project as someone who wanted to really understand who her neighbor was. And I wanted to understand the impact of that on her family who were part of that extended neighborhood.
1984. Yeah. I talked to a lot of survivors of state violence, either folks that survived their encounters or their families. And whenever I do an interview or if I'm responding to an incident, I always start with the humanity of the person, right? Because there's so much more than this headline. There's so much more than this act of violence. And that's something you do in the entire first chapter, per section of your book, which is divided into three parts. First section titled Eleanor, you call it, I believe, full personhood. Which I really appreciate. I might steal that term from you moving forward. Talk to us about her full personhood. Where was she from? Why did she migrate to New York City? What was life like? Just feel free to just go.
I wanted to tell a fuller story because in the 1980s, Eleanor Bumpus was so demonized as this mentally ill person who was overweight, who was a welfare recipient. And if you read any type of police narrative or any type of narrative by the police union or even the city official record about the killing, you really don't get a sense of who she really was. I mean, her family went out of their way, particularly in the black press, to talk about who she was. So Eleanor Bumpers was born in 1918. She's from North Carolina. Many people think that she's from New York City, but she's from North Carolina. Her mother died when she was 9 years old. By the time she's in her early 20s, she migrates to New York City during the 1940s. So she's part of that second great migration. And she migrates as a single mom. She has about two kids when she migrates. And by the end of the 1970s, she has 7 children, five daughters and 2 sons. So I wanted to tell a story about the different ways in which black women who are migrating, even as single mothers, oftentimes just are just having such a hard time. But this was a woman who was a single mom, working class woman. She worked as a domestic worker at the Waldorf Astoria, but she fiercely loved her children. When I interviewed her daughter, Mary Bumper, she always talked about her mother's cooking. She talked about the good times they had as a family. They danced a lot, they sang a lot. Eleanor Bumpers, she loved to cook. And that was part of her love language, which was cooking and passing down recipes. She loved radio soap operas. This is a woman who led a full life despite her economic status. But at the same time, she also, like any person, particularly at that time, as someone who is experiencing Jim Crow segregation of the North, experiencing that race, that gender, and that class discrimination, she also had other issues, right? Being a single mom is hard. By the time she's in her 50s, she has to, go on public assistance. And at the same time, this is someone who suffered from, different forms of mental health issues. So, like any of us, she had her good times, she had her challenges, but this was someone who was really a survivor and a fighter. And by the time that we get to her in October of 1984, when the public meets her at in death, she had lived a really long, complex, and really complicated life. But at the same time, this is her story is one of both struggle as well as a story of resilience.
Walk us through October 29th, 1984.
That was a tragic day. Eleanor Bumpers had stopped paying rent in about July 1984, and she's not evicted until October 1984. So between July and October of 1984, the housing authority had went through a series of housing procedures to evict her. At the same time, they also tried to get the Human Resources Administration, which is essentially the city welfare workers of the city, to try to help her in terms of paying her rent. Now, the city has always been in the business of paying out rent, preventing evictions from people who were what they would call, quote unquote, emotionally disturbed. Those services never came to Eleanor. In 1983, 1 year prior to her death, the city had spent at least an estimated $20 million in covering the rent of folks who had been who are were considered to be suffering from mental health issues. So before the eviction even happens, you see this kind of process of municipal disinvestment, right? She was already kind of left to the slaughter by the city because they could have prevented the eviction. So in 1984, on that October 29th, which is about, 29 days before after my 10th birthday, a couple of days before Halloween, they established a really kind of well-orchestrated eviction plan for her, but no post-eviction plan. So that particular day, outside of her apartment, she lived by herself in a one-bedroom apartment, a very neat apartment, I may add, outside of her door. There were at least two different police units There was the Housing Police Unit, which is not was not a part of the NYPD. Housing public projects have their own had their own policing at that time. And then they had the Emergency Service Unit Police. That particular unit is the special militarized unit. They carry like a lot of weapons. They're responsible. They're tasked with going in and getting out people who've like barricaded themselves in spaces. They're tasked with going in and handling people who are suffering from a mental health crisis. Also in the in that outside of her door were movers. Housing Authority had paid for movers to come and remove her property, as well as EMS workers, a few social workers, and a few neighbors were outside that door. So this was a really narrow hallway, and there were anywhere between 8 to 10 people in that hallway. It's unclear if Eleanor Bumpers understands what's happening, or she hears the commotion outside of her door. And essentially they knock on the door. They say, "This is the police. You need to come out." She ignores them. She curses at them. She yells at them. And again, this is someone who is having a mental health probably breakdown at that minute. So she has no idea what is about to happen. And even if we think about folks who are experiencing a mental health crisis, in that moment, large crowds and particularly police can exacerbate some of those conditions, right? So she ignores them. They end up taking the locks off her door and they go in. About six officers go into the apartment. And Stephen Sullivan, this is the person who shoots her, they allege, the NYPD alleges, as well as Stephen Sullivan, that she lunged at them with a knife. And Eleanor Bumpers was known to carry a knife, but the knife was seen as was considered to be like a security blanket. She never used it against anyone. They go in, he shoots her twice. The first shot is in the right hand, blowing off three fingers. You would think that if three fingers are blown off, that there's no way that someone could be holding a knife. He shoots her a second time, and the justification for the second shot to the chest is that she still had the knife in her hand and that she was coming after them. And on that day, they carry her out. The entire projects, folks, and this is around between 9:30 and 10:30 in the morning. So people hear the shots. People come outside. They're looking out their window, and they look outside and they see their neighbor, extremely bloody. It's a really horrific scene, and folks just start to, they get angry. They cry. They question why was so much police presence needed to evict somebody. And it was just really a sad affair. The one thing that I think is important to remember, even on that particular day, there was someone in that hallway that showed her a little bit of compassion, and that was her neighbor by the name of Florence Peaks. And the police allowed Florence Peaks to go to the door and try to coax her out of the apartment. And Florence Peaks said, "Mrs. Bumpers, this is Florence Peaks, your neighbor. I live down the street. I mean, I live down the hall. Please come out. The police are talking about, barging into the apartment." And in those moments, you can kind of see Florence Peaks, or as I was reading the primary sources, you can kind of just hear you can read the kind of compassion, like she didn't want anything to happen to her. So even in that really violent and horrific moment, there was this neighborly tenderness and compassion for for a life. She didn't want her to get hurt.
There's a couple of truths there that I just want to tug on quickly. We don't spend a lot of time there. One is Black people love our grannies. We love our grannies, right? And we all, those of us who live in the hood or, in our communities, right? We know who our grannies are. We watch them. They watch us. It's what we do. So there's that. Two, as I'm listening you talk about her neighbor, we Black people innately know what the potential outcomes are of any engagement with the cops and our folks, right? So Florence, in addition, you're the expert here. My guess is Florence, in addition to showing compassion, part of her motivation, perhaps for being at that door, was she was worried that exactly what happened was about to happen.
I mean, exactly. I totally agree, especially with seeing the level of weaponry that and the amount of police. One could assume that Florence and the other neighbors that were out there likely thought that something, someone would be harmed in that struggle. So I definitely agree with that. And yeah, you're right about, grannies and protection. I mean, one of the reasons why people gravitated towards this case so much in New York City and outside of New York City is because they imagined their own grandmothers being gunned down by the police. Wilbert Tatum, who was the editor of the New York Amsterdam News, said that Eleanor Bumpers had five daughters, seven children, almost at least 10 grandchildren. She was someone's grandmother and mother, and now she is our mother and grandmother, right? Really similar to how many of us felt about Trayvon Martin. Like he wasn't just a son of, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin. He became everybody's son, right? And the same thing happened with Eleanor. They could not believe that police would go in and shoot a grandmother. But the difference was the police didn't see a grandmother. They didn't see a mother. They saw someone who was violent. They saw somebody that had to be removed, from property. And they saw someone who, in their mind, was very, aggressive towards them as well as the housing police.
I mean, the same way they adultify our children, right? So when we're talking about and I'd be blocking that devil's name out of my head, Chauvin. At the same time Derek Chauvin was being tried for the murder of George Floyd, a 16-year-old child was gunned down, that people referred to as a woman. This is a woman. Nah, she was a baby. But this is the dehumanization of us that allows them to at least attempt to justify this stuff to the rest of the public, because the public doesn't see us as human either at large.
And that's the work that families have to do too, right? So while they are pursuing justice, right, they have to go on this tour of convincing the world, the public, that their family members were, mothers, daughters, brothers, sisters, right? Like we know that. And now you see families doing, I mean, now families have the space to write memoirs about their loved ones. Back in the 1980s, that wasn't happening. They didn't have those spaces unless they did that within the black press. So part of that legal justice work is telling a particular type of narrative that counters the police narrative, that counters the city narrative of their loved one, in addition to grieving in a very public way. And that was, that's the other kind of interesting thing about families, that they're not allowed necessarily to grieve privately, right? They have to do it in a very public way.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with LaShawn Harris, who has a new book out called Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. I want to talk a little bit now, LaShawn, about, I'm going to tie two questions together. The conditions of 1980s New York, 1980s Reaganomics, for those of us still old enough or old enough to know what that means. The way those things exacerbate, contribute to what happens to Eleanor, right? Similar question, like said differently. I'm asking you to tie state violence, state terror, to the violence of racism, poverty, gentrification, evictions, houselessness.
I'll try my best.
You'll do
So
it. You do it in the book. You can do it here.
this is definitely, I mean, I'll start a little bit earlier. I mean, in the 1970s, New York City is coming off an era, going into the 1980s, they're coming off an era of night of economic, physical austerity. During the 1970s, New York City is like basically bankrupt. This physical austerity means the cutting and slashing of social services, slashing of services for people who depended on aid that were kind of really lifeline for families. So coming into Reaganomics, if you were already a working class or working poor person in 1980s New York, it's exacerbated by Reaganomics because the city had already been suffering and working class people and poor people had already been suffering since the 1970s. So your condition is exacerbated. So when Reagan comes and we see the continuation of municipal disinvestment from the poor and from working class people with the slashing and cutting of, Medicaid and other programs of food stamps. We see the programs that are cut to kind of similar to what we're seeing now to kind of fund, an expansion of carceral regimes, prisons, to expand the presence of police in certain communities, particularly black and brown communities. And also during this particular time, we also hear like the rhetoric of what Ronald Reagan's America should look like. So it's about deregulation of, companies. It's about this kind of personal and individual responsibility. And it's also about waging a war against those who are dependent on state and federal aid, like the welfare system. So welfare becomes like public enemy number one during that particular time. And those who are on it, particularly black women and their children, also become public enemy number one. I mean, this is the same person, the same person who talks about, the era of the welfare queen when he was governor of California in the 1970s, right? So if you are already suffering, your economic situation is even worse. And there's also less sympathy from the public, particularly white New Yorkers who are Republican and white New Yorkers who are conservative Democrats already, who are, anti-immigrant, anti-black, anti-poor. This makes it really hard for when things do happen to black people, whether they are unhoused, whether they are someone like Eleanor Bumpus who's facing an eviction. It makes it hard to kind of to have sympathy for those particular people, right? And the sympathy is always for like the state. The sympathy is always for the police officers. So 1980s for black people in general, particularly working class and working poor people, is not a great time with the slashing of services. And it's not a great time because if you are a problem economically, you are responsible for that problem. You are to blame. And the government is not in the business or does not care to help you out of those situations because they don't believe in, these kind of public social safety nets.
Something about that's ringing very true in this present moment as well. It's like, history on steroids right now. One of the things, thank you for that context. One of the things I really appreciate about the way you speak about your engagement with the family, is the reverence. That's the word I'll give it, that you hold them. So, say for Mary Bumpers, and you can talk a bit more about her if you'd like, Eleanor Bumpers' second oldest child, I believe.
That's right.
The rest of the family elected not to speak
That's
with
right.
you. There are actually best practices for dealing with people, families that are holding this specific kind of trauma, because it's a specific kind of trauma. And th those practices often go ignored, or they get set aside because people are chasing headlines and money. There's this whole, cause celeb thing that has happened in this movement that makes me bananas. You talk to me, please talk to us about why you innately understood why it was important for you to hold the family in regards, even though you acknowledge, in the introduction, like there were definitely things that, you wish you had been able to get, but it was more important to re regard the wishes. And you can tie into there because we have limited time. I could talk to you for hours about this. There's sort of a second killing of the people's loved ones that happen, right? Through the demonization of their loved ones, the way that their loved ones are talked about, and through the very public attacking of the surviving family by the state, by the public, by the media. It's an onslaught.
Yeah. Well, I knew that I had to talk with the family. I'm not trained in oral history. My first book is on the early 20th century, 1920s, 1930s. But I knew I had to talk to the family because the state record, as well as newspaper, again, particularly mainstream white newspapers, had demonized them so badly. And that was not the narrative that I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell a different type of narrative. And initially, I thought, I'm from this neighborhood. My parents knew Mary Bumpers decades ago. Not that she would remember, but knew her decades ago. This is going to be easy. I got it. They'll easily talk to me. And that was not the case at all. Mary Bumpers was very forthcoming. She was great in that she invited me into her home. She opened up her life to me. She opened up old wounds, a really dark chapter in her life. And I appreciated that because after I left, after those times after interviewing her, I would go home and look at the information. But she was still there in that space in 1984, right? So for her to kind of open up those emotions, like those raw emotions, and continue to stay in that space after I left, it was problematic for me at times. I thought about those times where, I'm going home, I'm gonna watch TV, but she was still probably there in 1984. And with the rest of the family, they elected not to. And, I decided just, I need to respect their wishes. And if I want to do by right by Eleanor Bumpers, just leave them alone. They had been in the spotlight throughout the 1980s and 1990s, and they chose not to. And the only thing I can do is respect their wishes and try to tell a complete and whole story that they would be proud of. Like, so I felt myself, this is not a commissioned project, but I felt like I had to be accountable to to her and her family, because the public, not black and brown people, and there were many white people who were supporters, but there was a segment of the population that were just horrible to the Bumpers family, even to the daughters, as you say, this kind of post mortem vilification of Eleanor, but also the daughters. And for your audience, the daughters were cast as women who had abandoned their mother. So they talked a lot about like maternal neglect, elderly neglect. When the daughters, they file a lawsuit in December of 1984, a couple of months after their mother is murdered. And the press talked a lot about how they were money hungry. And this is even in like official city reports. So I knew that talking to Mary and getting her perspective, like things that she didn't even give to the news, to reporters, things that she didn't even say, was important to telling a fuller story. Because I think that oftentimes what happens is, just like with victims, when we write these histories about state violence victims, we marginalize the people who are harmed in those histories, and we totally forget about those family members and the slow violence that happens after their loved one is killed. And by slow violence, I'm talking about a type of violence that is, it's gradual, and it happens over time, over days, months, years, decades. It's also important to remember that after those scathing reports come out about the family and Mary Bumpers as this really outspoken, fierce, I'm going to fight for my mother, they suggest that, the family shouldn't be upset that they had a role in their mother being evicted because they didn't respond to these eviction letters, which was not true. They didn't get eviction letters, right? So I thought it was important to kind of get Mary's perspective on that. In addition to that, you also have ordinary white people who are supporters of the police, who are also sending, calling and threatening the family, right? Eleanor Bumpers is buried in an unmarked grave in Long Island, and that might be for several reasons. It may be because the family didn't have enough money to get a plot. But it also may be because the family was scared for that that her grave would be desecrated too, right? So even after she was killed, all of these horrific things happened to the family, and I had to talk with, I mean, Mary was the key person. She was the one who was going and writing protest letters. She was out there marching with David Dinkins and Herbert Daughtry, who was the founder of the Black United Front. She was out there marching with Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis and Tuskegee Airmen, who later becomes the president of Bronx Community College, Roscoe Brown. So I had to talk with her. If she decided not to talk with me, I don't think I wouldn't have had a book.
I didn't know that piece about the grave being unmarked until engaging with you. Not surprised though for a little known fact aside from those of us that are in the movement. Every year, the Chicago Police Department shoots up the grave of Chairman Fred Hampton Sr. Every year, without fail.
And I think about Emmett Till and how his placard in Mississippi, you always hear these news reports about that marker being shot up.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with LaShawn Harris. She has a new book out called Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. Stephen Sullivan. Let's talk about him for a minute. What did we come to learn? What did the family come to learn about Stephen Sullivan? I'm just gonna say straight up, I Googled to see where he's been. He reared his ugly head after Sean Bell was murdered. I'm saying he had empathy for the cops. Talk to us about Sullivan.
So Sullivan was a former Marine. He had a wife and two teenage children when this happened. He lived outside of New York City in Putnam County. And he had been a career officer. He had been with the NYPD for at least, by the time we get to 1984, at least 10 to 15 years. So this is an experienced cop. This was his first killing. This is the third time he had fired off his weapon, and he just happened to have the shotgun. Initially, when they were going to Eleanor's apartment, when they're in the elevator, another police officer had the shotgun, and Stephen Sullivan noticed that that officer's shoe was untied, and the guy said to him, "I'll tie, you know, take the gun." And I'll tie my shoe. So the other cop ties his shoe and he never retrieves the shotgun. So when they get off the elevator, Stephen Sullivan just happens to have the rifle, the gun. But this was someone who was defended by the police union lawyer. It doesn't appear in a lot of primary sources, newspapers, any sympathy for the Bumpers family or Eleanor? It seems very, at least from my reading of the primary sources, that it's very much about, kind of toting the police line of this person was dangerous and they, excessive force was needed. So after Stephen Sullivan shoots Eleanor Bumpers in October of 1984, he is indicted. He's indicted in late January, and that's in 1985. And his trial doesn't start until 1987, January of 1987. So there's a 2 to 3 year legal battle to bring him to court because initially the indictment was thrown out. And the New York Court of Appeals in 1986 reinstated that indictment. And for people who know the case, is this here's a spoiler, but for people who know the case, he is acquitted. And his trial is a trial by not by jury, but it's a bench trial. So it's a trial by judge. He elects to have a judge decide his fate. And he gets off. And a couple of this is in February of 1987, and after he gets off, 2 or 3 months later, he is promoted to detective. and he stays on the force for another, I believe, I may have my dates wrong, but another 10 years and retires and becomes, I believe, a bus driver. And recently he just passed away. He passed away in July of 2025. And initially, I wanted to interview him. I wanted to interview him as well as his family. And I don't think I tried hard enough, but I would have, it would have been interesting to interview him, but I didn't get the opportunity to interview him or his family, meaning his wife and his two children.
Yeah, I wonder though too, right? Like if you had been writing this book, so the movement against state terror is in a very different place now. The conversation we're having about police violence is not the conversation we're having in the 1980s. This is sort of an anomaly, right? It really wasn't every once in a while we're having these big conversations like we had about Eleanor. I don't know, they would have said yes. Well, maybe now with the Trump administration, maybe now he'd say yes. But who knows?
I think, yeah, I mean, yeah, they probably would have blown, yeah, probably would have said no. They probably would have said no with the assumption and the right assumption that, I had a particular angle and lens. But I just felt like as a historian, right,
No, that's understandable.
the kind of look at all of the evidence. I mean, I interviewed the person who prosecuted him, the lawyer, Lawrence Larry Leibowitz. So I interviewed him. I interviewed the city lawyer who settled the Bumpers lawsuit in the 1980s. This was Dinkins city lawyer. And, the family had, well, Eleanor Mary Bumpers had, certain things to say about those particular individuals. But again, I felt like it was needed to have those voices too, and to kind of hear what they thought in the 1980s and how they were thinking about the case now in hindsight, 30, 40 years later.
Couple more questions for you, LaShawn Harris. What, if any, so there was big mobilization, there was a fight for accountability for justice, multiple organization, multiple people, Mary Bumpers involved. What, if any, wins did the community experience in terms of shifts in material conditions that impact quality of life? Did the community win anything? Did anything change for Black people as a result of the fight for accountability? I don't use the word justice in these cases. Accountability for the murder of Eleanor Bumpers.
I'm gonna say no. I'm gonna say no, because we're still here. Like we still have these cases. We're still fighting against police violence and state violence, right? These cases are still with us. But at the same time, I think that during the 1980s, at least the cases that I have been looking at, which would include the Michael Stewart case of 1983, of graffiti artist who was beaten and hogtied by police, fell into a coma and died. That was a year before Eleanor Bumpers. 1985, Edmund Perry was an honor student killed by a police officer in Harlem. I'm thinking about a couple of months after Eleanor Bumpers was killed, December 1984, the Bernard Goetz case, the subway vigilante, a white man shoots four African American teens, black women who are killed by the police during the 1980s. Several months after Eleanor Bumpers, Sharon Walker killed by a black off-duty officer, as well as Yvonne Smallwood, 1980, I think this is 1987, beaten by police and eventually dies. The thing that I notice about those cases, unlike now, is that a lot of those cases, those men, many of them, they went up for indictment. Those cases went before a grand jury. The cases went up before a grand jury, and there were some indictments in those cases. Whereas now it seems like, I mean, you have to really pressure and beat down prosecutors to bring a case before a grand jury. And it's not to say that those things are not happening now. It seemed like in the 1980s, you saw more, I guess maybe we may call them now, I guess, progressive prosecutors in a sense, not afraid to bring cops before grand juries. That's what Mario Merola does. He brings Stephen Sullivan before grand jury, and he's a pro he would be considered a progressive cop. So I mean, a progressive a DA. But in terms of the outcome with some of these cases, I think we're still in that spot where families are still undergoing loss. The communities are still undergoing loss. As you already stated, legal justice is often nowhere to be found. So I don't know what type of material gains. I mean, if you talk to police officers or anyone who's about like police reform, they may point to reform efforts, right? But we know that extra, you know, all this additional training and reform often doesn't work because people are still dying. In the case of the Bumpers family, material gains may come, you know, amount to lawsuit money, which is never, doesn't bring anybody back, nor do families get the money that they actually sue for. You know, they sued for $10 million. The city settled with them in the 1980s, and this is under Dinkins, who was a supporter of Eleanor Bumpers. They settled out of court for over $400,000, but the city only gave them $200,000. And that's because they put a lien on the money. You know, so, a $400,000 is not a lot of money, but if you're a working class poor family, that's a lot of money. But to get back $200,000 because the city decides to put a lien on the money, is nothing. You know, each daughter got a little less than $20,000. So I don't know about material gains. I don't know about any type of reform that would result in not losing anybody because we're still having this issue. In 2016, Deborah Danner, another Bronx woman, you know, killed in her home by an NYPD officer. And again, this additional training, right? If they're trained in de-escalation, then why are people still continuing to die? And even if death is not the result, there's still this everyday harm that people face, right? You know, the harassment, the surveillance, if the under protection, right? So in terms of material gains, I don't know if I can answer that question in I guess a positive way. But I definitely don't, I don't see that.
Thank you,
Thank you.
LaShawn Harris. I'm gonna end it on that because I actually don't feel a need to pivot to a positive. It's not a positive. We're still just talking about one every 28 hours. We're still talking about the fact that despite Dr. Kimberle Crenshaw launching in 2014, say her name, we still don't have the amount of conversations we need to be having about women's engagement with law enforcement that results in harm, rape, incarceration, and/or death. The New York Police Department remains one of the most brutal police departments in the country. The only thing that I uplift regularly as a positive point in all of this work is something that you alluded to earlier, the family networks now.
Yes. Oh,
Right?
yes.
Families United
Oh,
for
yes.
Justice, that I have the distinct privilege of being at FUFJ, Families United for Justice Conference, almost every year. Everybody from Eric Garner's mother to now Sonya Massey's father, right? And these families, they are something else.
I love this because you see the same thing in the 1980s with these black women coming together, supporting each other, calling each other on birthdays, on death anniversaries. And it reminds me of those black women during the early 20th century who came together when their sons were lynched, right? Or were their sons, I think about the Scottsboro Boys mothers, you know, when they were trying to, you know, railroad those, when they ended up railroading them, but how those mothers came together, right? This like rich tradition of black women's organizing, right? And doing for one another. So yes to your point.
Y'all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been LaShawn Harris. Her book that we've been discussing is Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.